got a quorum, so let's get this meeting started. State Government Finance. Start out with Representative Hewitt. The minutes from March 20th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative John Hewitt moves the approval of the minutes to March 20th, 2019. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Representative Elkins moves the approval of the minutes of March 21st. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Our minutes are out of the way. Representative Bernardi, why don't we get welcome to the committee. And I'll move House File 2533 for possible inclusion.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate seeing all the members this morning, and thank you for the opportunity to testify on what I consider a very important bill.
And if you want to explain your bill, and then when your testifier gets ready, she can say her name for the tape, and then we can go with the testimony. So, Representative.
Okay. Well, the bill is very simple. And what it does is it will provide funding to be appropriated in 2021 from the general fund to the Legislative Coordinating Commission for the Office on the Economic Status of Women. So that's what the bill does. And I just wanted to give you just a little bit of history, how it came about and why the funding is needed. And the commission, what the mission of the commission or the function is, the commission shall study and report to the legislature on all matters relating to economic status of women in Minnesota. The Office of the Economic Status of Women advises the legislator and provides information and statistics on women in Minnesota. OESW, which is the Office of Economic Status of Women, also serves as an informal liaison between the legislature and the community. The legislature creates, in 1976 is when it was formed, and the legislator creates the Advisory Council on Economic Status of Women, comprised of legislators and public members appointed by the governor. We're here, it's transformed itself a little bit over the years, and in 2019 is why we're here before the committee today. The legislator prohibits hiring staff for the economic status of women and eliminates its funding. I know I've had experience with economic status of women. How I got to know them the most was reading the findings that they found out. And one of the most profound findings that I got from them, and it helped me in the work that I do, is regarding transportation. They went around the state of Minnesota, greater Minnesota. They didn't do the metro area, but they did greater Minnesota. And they learned about what were the barriers to the economic status of women. And to my surprise that it's been confirmed now, and you can correct me if this is not right, but the number one barrier for women in greater Minnesota for economic security is transportation. I thought that was fascinating. And then in so many other areas, it's transportation is a barrier for getting children to quality child care and other things. So and getting them to medical doctors. But I learned a lot from the work that they did, and it's helped in the legislation that I write to help serve all Minnesotans. And with me today is the former executive director, Barbara Batiste, and I'd like her to be able to talk with the committee.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Batiste, and I was director of the Office on the Economic Status of Women from 2014 to 2017. 2017 is when funding was eliminated for the office, so the office has been closed for 2 years now. I'd like to address the need for a special legislative office focusing on women's economic security, and then also explain what OESW is and what it does. Now, although today many women attain college degrees and most women are in the paid workforce, the fact remains that women overall make less than men. And those who suffer the most from this disparity are single mothers, minority and immigrant women, and older women. So why do women earn less? Part of the reason is outright discrimination, but that's actually a very small percentage of the cause. Part of the reason are the careers that women choose. are 10 to choose: nurses, social workers, nonprofit workers, food service, retail, childcare. By far the largest reason, though, is that women work fewer hours over their careers than men. So why? Women bear children. We take time off for childbirth and caring for infants. Women are very likely to be the principal caregivers for their children. So this means women take time off work if children are sick, or their meetings with teachers, snow days, doctor's appointments. And women are less likely to stay late at the office because they're often the ones rushing home to take care of the children. Women are also more likely than men to be caregivers for aging parents or spouses, and this leads to more time off work and often to early retirement. OESW is a nonpartisan office, and it's within the Legislative Coordinating Commission. As Representative Bernardi said, it was created in 1976 by the legislature. It has one staff person. Its annual budget is about $145,000. Two of the handouts you were given are examples of the type of information OESW provides. And I must say, these are available in color on the OESW website, which makes them a little more impressive. But the black and white versions still give an idea of the type of content and the depth and the detail of OESW reports. One of these documents is an OESW bi-monthly newsletter, and this particular edition summarizes a new OESW report on women-owned businesses in Minnesota. Minnesota women-owned businesses are not only compared to men-owned businesses in this report, but they're also broken down by race and ethnicity. No one else has developed this data, only OESW. This report shows that women are starting businesses in Minnesota at an astonishing rate, and that women-owned businesses are really significant to the state economy. However, women-owned businesses tend to be less profitable and have fewer employees than male-owned businesses. I think the most valuable part of this report is on pages 10 and 11 of this newsletter. And this looks at the reasons why women-owned businesses tend to be smaller and less profitable. This is information that legislators can use to help women-owned businesses be more successful. The other document, if you could look at, is an OESW fact sheet on women in Minnesota's elected offices. I believe the most notable fact is that 51% of Minnesota's counties in 2015 had no women on the county boards. 84% had one or no women, only one or no women on their county boards. In addition to research reports and newsletters, OESW publishes detailed annual summaries of any new legislation that affects women's economic security. Excuse me. OESW also reviews every bill that's introduced and prepares a briefing letter or paper for legislators if there's a significant negative or positive economic impact on women. As Representative Bernardi said, OESW also holds listening sessions throughout the state every summer and fall, asking women what their economic successes have been and what barriers remain to their economic success. And OESW then publishes an annual report on these listening sessions for legislators to use. I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak on this bill? If not, questions for members. I see no questions. You're going to get off easy today.
Right, yes.
I will renew my motion that House File 2533 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
And members.
Thank you for your time.
Yep.
Representative Hewitt. What's that? I don't see Representative Hewitt. He must have stepped out. Representative Tapke. And as he's coming down, I'll move House File 2018 for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee, and please describe your bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm always happy to clean up after Hewitt. That's it's always a good thing to do. But, Mr. Chair and members, we have House file 2018 in front of us today. It is a bill with multiple technical and different changes for the Minnesota Racing Commission. The Minnesota Racing Commission in the state of Minnesota oversees and manages Canterbury Park in Shakopee and also Running Aces in the North Metro. And here today we have Mr. Tom DePasquale, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, to walk through the bill. Mr. Chair, if you would like him to proceed.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape, and then you can proceed with walking us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom DePasquale, Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and thank you for having us again. We were here with Mr. Skirto earlier this session to brief you on our budget, and this touches on some of those same issues. And I want to thank Representative Dapke and Representative Albright for supporting the bill. You may recall from our budget session that the commission is entirely financed by the racing industry. We don't draw funds from the general budget. We have a special revenue fund that finances our operations entirely. Some of the sections of the bill that are of interest to this committee were actually passed last year, went through both chambers, and were vetoed in the omnibus finance bill. We have been through commerce, judiciary, and government operations, and I believe this may be our last stop. So I'll focus on two provisions that I think are primarily of interest to this committee that are explained in our fiscal note. The first one is the change from annual reports to reports every 2 years. The commission spends about 2 months and hundreds of hours of time publishing this almost Pulitzer Prize worthy annual report. And oddly enough, you may be aware that Minnesota law prohibits us from giving it to you. There's actually a statute that says annual reports cannot be distributed to the legislature unless you specifically ask for it. So what I've taken to doing in the last couple of years is to send a letter to the committee chairs and ranking members summarizing in a one-pager what we think are our primary accomplishments and inviting you to ask us for this annual report. So if you're interested in the report, we're happy to provide you with one. The statute requires us to report on our operations, any policy recommendations that we have, and our organization chart, et cetera. Most of those things are pretty static. They don't change from year to year. What I think is important at the beginning of the biennium is to provide you with a fulsome report. And so our suggestion is to move to biennial reporting. That would save us $1,500 in publication costs. And we could put that money to good use using social media, email blast, website updates, and other means of reaching out to policymakers. And, of course, I'm happy to come and testify anytime you want to visit. The second change has to do with racing and gaming vendors. This is a category of an occupational license that we already have. We have about 29 categories of occupational licenses, and we license and do background checks on all of those parties. We do about 6,000 background checks a year on licensees. And many of those licensees provide racing and gaming equipment that are really core to the integrity of horse racing and card playing. It's the tote companies at each of the tracks. It's the satellite system that sends the export signal of races that are run at our tracks and import signals from hundreds of tracks around the country. There are also multinational gaming companies, electronic card game companies, and card and chip manufacturers. These are the people that take an extraordinary amount of time to do background checks. They often have many key employees that we check the background of each of their principals. We make sure there's not any administrative actions against them in other states. So they're much more labor intensive to approve each year as opposed to the people who are involved in racing and come in and whose license fees of $10 or $25 truly reflect the cost of regulating them. These companies also could be the subject of enforcement actions, which would be costly for the commission in the event they violate any of our rules or laws. So our hard costs alone for processing any license applicant is about $25. That's labor, that's materials, that's doing a background check on clear and general overhead costs of equipment, IT support, et cetera. So these particular vendors have been paying $100 a year in Minnesota for their licenses since 1984, when the statute first went into effect. They've never had a fee increase. In many states, they pay several thousands or tens of thousands of dollars to do business in the state. There is a statute that requires the legislature to approve our fee increases, which is why I'm before you now. And if you approve this section, then we would promulgate a rule that would differentiate between those garden variety vendors, like we always say the nut lady at Canterbury, or food and beverage vendors, versus gaming companies that require more strict regulatory oversight. And we want the cost to reflect the cost of regulating them. So those are the, and that has an impact of $15,000 coming into us from a handful or so of these racing and gaming vendors that would pay increased license fees. This also allows us to keep the fees constant for many of those other licensees, like grooms and jockeys and other people who pay anywhere from $10 to $50 typically for their licenses in Minnesota. So those are the financial aspects of it. I'm happy to discuss any other section of the bill that's of interest to you, but I thought those are the things that would be of most interest to this committee.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Quam, you had a question.
Thank you.
Go ahead. I missed you. But go ahead, Representative Quam, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm curious as to why the on 119 through 121, you get rid of the bond.
Mr. DiPasquale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, we looked at every agency, commission, and board in the state of Minnesota. We are the only non-law enforcement agency, commission, or board that's required to bond our commissioners. We have 9 commissioners appointed by the governor. They don't do audits, handle any money or anything. So over the years, we spent about $500 a year bonding our commissioners to meet the statutory requirement. But in point of fact, the bonding company often has to pigeonhole the bond certificate into this requirement because it's so unusual. And there's just no reason to bond them. Those people are protected. Our commissioners are under the State Tort Claims Act, and they also have common law and statutory immunity. So there's no reason to bond them. They don't handle money or get involved in that.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, I don't think the other commissioners are involved in, I guess, where there's gambling. And is it common for other states to have this type of a bonding?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we're the only state that has a bonding requirement for racing commissioners.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then 2.14, why are you changing from 1 year to 5 years? I mean, that seems to be a very dramatic change on the licensing.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the commission has adopted the Association of Racing Commissioners International Schedule for medication, prohibited substances, and penalties. And there's a prescriptive penalty grid based on the severity and frequency of the violation. And the penalty for a 3-time offender of a serious doping violation is up to 5 years. We had an instance this past year where we had a 2nd-time violator where the prescribed penalty would have been up to 3 years and up to $25,000. And because of this limitation in our statute, the assistant attorney general who worked with the commission on issuing the order determined that we only had statutory authority to sanction suspend for up to 1 year. That means that we cannot comply with national uniform standards for sanctions for serious offenses.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 3.3 through 3.8, why are we deleting out the administrative law judge portion of the statute?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually, we're not striking the right of a licensee to an administrative hearing. We're raising the threshold for the option for an administrative hearing before a law judge to 1 year and a penalty of $10,000 or more and a penalty of 1 year. The reason for that is that a person's first serious offense is subject to up to 1 year and up to $10,000 penalties, and we believe that those matters should be heard by the Board of Stewards, primarily because they're the ones with the most experience. They can handle it during the race meet. If you go to a contested case, you may be waiting a year or longer for the matter to be resolved. And we are the only agency that we're aware of that we're not allowed to actually rule on a matter before the matter is referred to a judge, and we think the commission should handle those matters at first blush, and then there's a right to appeal.
Representative Quall.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then on 8.23 through 8.25, I understand getting rid of the names of the committees because they change frequently. And then somewhere else you have on odd numbered years by February 15th to give a financial report out. But if you're maintaining the language 8.23, but you're deleting out where you're sending that to, isn't there a gap, or is there somewhere else a statute with an inferred that you're going to report it to the committees with the authority or jurisdiction?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a requirement in the Office of Grant Management, I believe in its rules, that requires recipients of grants to report back to the grantor each year, and it's also a condition of our contracts. This grant is fairly new to the commission in the sense that we have funds. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. The Breeders' Fund has had this grant program for some years, but we've put in place strict compliance with the Office of Grants Management reporting requirements and granting requirements. So we have a rigorous process where we review applicants for grants, decide on those that are most meritorious, and then we have contracts that require them to report back to us each year on how they've done with the money.
Representative Quall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertas. I apologize for missing the first on the list.
That's quite all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions also relate to the issue of licensing and the different classes and the civil fines or penalties that seem to be imposed. It's my presumption that the Racing Commission would be the sole jurisdiction that issues all of these licenses in which you can impose a civil fine. Is that correct?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I noticed in Section 6 you have the ability to enter into license agreements or compacts with other comparable bodies. So in those situations where you didn't issue the license but a comparable body issued the license, do you still have authority and discretion to impose civil fines for those licensees?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, thank you for that question. We wanted to clarify in this section that Minnesota's racing participants would have the option to join a national racing compact for licensing. Currently, there's 24 states that are either members or participants in a multi-jurisdictional licensing program that reviews applicants and allows those applicants to exercise their license privileges in all member states. They apply the strictest scrutiny to applicants. In other words, the highest bar in any state they incorporate into their criteria. If a party meets those criteria, they're recommended for licensing, and then we would issue a badge and a license. if they're not qualified for licensing, the National Racing Compact simply refers the matter to the state commission, that would be us, and we would make a determination as to whether they should be denied a license or issued a conditional license. Our horse people have asked for this because many of our participants come from other states that have multi-jurisdictional license, and they could be licensed for more than 1 year, and they can go to Iowa, Illinois, Arizona, and Minnesota and exercise their privileges in all states, but we still maintain jurisdiction over them when they're in Minnesota.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, with regard to the licensing and your ability to keep the revenues from the civil fines and penalties, isn't it a little self-serving in some respects that you don't have an independent body that's imposing these fines? It seems like it's a little bit like the fox guarding the chicken coop. I mean, you go through a process of qualifying and licensing somebody, and I understand the need to keep the Racing Commission and the whole operation of gambling and racing clean, but it seems like there would almost be an incentive, which on one hand might be good, to be extra scrutinous of the conduct or behavior of licensees, but on the other hand, the amounts and the amount of fines and civil penalties, this is not small change. You're talking about $50,000 to $200,000 based on license class. Could you describe in some of these license classes just exactly what kind of violation would impose a $200,000 civil fine?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, the numbers are eye-popping, but let me give you some background. A Class A and B licensee is for the management and ownership of the racetrack. So we have two Class A and B licensees in Minnesota. And Class C licensees are all the occupational licenses and basically racing participants, employees of the tracks, et cetera. This has been in rule since the beginning of our statute in 1984. The only reason we're moving it into this section now, and you're seeing it for the first time, is because we're aware of another statute in Minnesota that precludes an agency from imposing a penalty of more than $700 absent express statutory authority. And out of an abundance of care, we didn't want to have somebody assert a frivolous defense to a violation that we didn't have that authority, which has always been presumed to be ours. We've never imposed a fine on the racetracks. Up until a couple of years ago, I actually found that our predecessors had passed a rule that precluded the commission from fining a racetrack unless there was a contested case. So, you know, why would you incur that cost and go through a year and a half to assess a relatively minor fine? With respect to occupational licensees, we issue about 200 rulings a year. Most of them, all of them, are issued by the stewards, the judges at each track. They could be for misuse of the riding crop, late to the paddock, medication violations, that's your garden variety overage of a therapeutic medication that we find out in a post-race test after we send the blood sample to the lab. In the typical year, that ranges from $40,000 to $50,000 in total fines. Historically, they had always gone to the general revenue fund, but because of our aftercare initiative for horses coming off the track, the legislature amended that law a couple years ago to say that our fines go for aftercare of racehorses, and that's where the grant money comes in. So we have a grant program where we give our fine money to 501c3 organizations that take horses off of Minnesota's racetracks and prepare them or use them in new careers. So that's where the money goes. It's roughly $50,000 a year. Finally, every state, the 38 states that have racing, the commissions have the authority to impose fines. It's only when the fines or penalties get to extraordinary amounts that you may find that they're handled by administrative law judges in contested cases.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my last question relates to something you said regarding the threshold in which an administrative law judge, somebody maybe third party and objective, I think I heard you say $10,000 is the amount of money in which you would have that ability to for an appellate process. Given some of these license descriptions that you have, and it sounds like maybe even some of the people working in the stables or whatever, administration of medications or whatever might be the case. And I don't pretend to know everything about horse racing, but it would seem that that's kind of a high bar to have a third-party administrative law judge, you know, in a more neutral position to before you have the right in an appellate process to go that far. And I don't know what kind of money these licensees make, but $10,000 would be a pretty big hit, and I don't know what the cost of an appellate process is going to be, but maybe you could be a little more specific to that issue. I can't imagine somebody in a stable that maybe makes $30,000 to $50,000 should be subjected to a $10,000 fine and not have a right of appeal and protections that we would normally afford other individuals.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've only imposed one fine of that magnitude in our 35 or more year history of racing here. The typical fine is really quite a bit less than that. I think that this is the benefit everybody. The people who know the most are the stewards. They're the officials. And when there is a serious doping violation, of which we've only had a handful in the history of Minnesota racing, it's appropriate that the people that know the most, in our case, the Board of Stewards of Canterbury had over 100 years of experience as administrative officials in racing, that they should be the ones that hear the case of first impression. All the attributes of due process are afforded the licensee, the right to counsel or representation by anybody, prior notice of the hearing. We share the information with them before the hearing. They can ask for a stay, which I typically grant until such time as the matter is heard and resolved on appeal. So they have due process rights at all stages of the process. They have similar due process rights when it goes to a panel of commissioners. Under our rules, that's typically the route of appeal for a lesser offense. And then this is only for the most serious cases. The administrative law case that we're involved in last year, we spent probably $75,000 to recover a $10,000 fine. We spent a year and a half litigating it. It's an extraordinary case where we would take that enforcement to that level. It's a second lifetime serious doping violation in that instance. 99.9% of the cases are handled at the track by the commission in a routine manner.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, good morning.
Good morning.
I note on page 8 that you've broadened the opportunity for research and related education, public institutions of post-secondary learning in the state. And I'm just wondering, was that by request based upon the equine industry or just rather than the narrowness of just the University of Minnesota?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, we did that for two reasons. One is we're broadening our outreach to the secondary, post-secondary learning institutions. We have a collaborative program with the University of Minnesota at Crookston. We've approached Rochester. And the standard bred grants allow us to issue grants to any public institution of secondary, post-secondary learning, but the thoroughbred and quarter horse grants were more limited. So in order to make them, put them on equal footing, we simply mirrored the language.
Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, I note in subdivision 5 on page 11 with regard to exclusions by the racetrack, just for the benefit of the members on the committee, just hoping that you could expand on the rationale for why that's so important.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Albright, this was requested by the tracks, and we researched the law in many other racing states. We're the only state that had a serious restriction on the ability of racetracks to maintain a safe and customer-friendly environment. And so we had a situation where parties could actually appeal an exclusion to the commission, and we got involved in overseeing the private property rights of the tracks. So the way we've drafted this, they can exclude parties for any lawful reason, which more or less incorporates the law of public accommodations and human rights and things of that sort. And there is no appeal right to the commission, except for licensees who are treated differently because they're under our jurisdiction, and they have other pathways of appeal under our procedural rules. But we think that this is in the interest of maintaining a friendly environment at the tracks, and they shouldn't be treated any differently from other private businesses.
So Commissioner, you couldn't exclude Representative Albright from the track at all times. That would be a violation of other laws. Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, and not that they haven't tried. And I appreciate, because I think what we prided ourselves down in Scott County, and Representative Tabke and I are supportive of this bill for a number of reasons. But it is very family-friendly. It draws in a whole host of people. We've been down there for the ostrich races, and we've also participated in some pretty exciting wiener dog races. We have to actually run a rut through the dirt so that the little doggies can get through. But I think it does not enforce, but encourage a family-friendly atmosphere without the worry of activity that just prohibits an enjoyable experience at the racetrack. I might add in conversations offline, Mr. Commissioner, that one of the representatives on the committee might be interested in taking on the responsibility for a couple of retired horses. And so maybe after the committee, you might want to talk with Representative Carlson. He's got an interest in bringing a couple home to his kids.
Any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2018 be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you, and thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
And now the House, Representative Hewitt, represent our House File 893. And if you want to make a motion, it's going to be held over for possible inclusion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that House File 893 be held over for possible inclusion in your omnibus bill.
And welcome to the committee, and I apologize for having to bump you out last week, but you know how things go. And Representative Hughes, if you want to describe your bill. And
Mr. Chair, House File 893 is actually one of the most exciting bills I've worked on this term, simply because the people were so good to work with. It was my first bill I took, and they made it quite enjoyable. I never knew that I'd get this excited about an accounting bill. This bill actually is a really good bill for the simple reason it takes away some fees that are unnecessary. It cleans up some bad behavior. It gives them tools to clean up bad behavior. Takes the accounting world out of the Pony Express and does a little bit of cleanup work too. So I'm going to turn it over to my testifier to explain the details of that. And if you need me, I am here.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Good morning. My name is Doreen Johnson, and I am the Executive Director at the Minnesota Board of Accountancy. Thank you for this introduction and the opportunity to appear before you. I agree. I was an investigator at the original part of my life, and so one of the main areas of this bill is to allow for retroactive enforcement for certified public accountants. We have a one-year renewal cycle, and we have had dishonorable or disreputable CPAs run out the clock and simply not renew their license in the middle of an enforcement case. And so we are asking this body to give us the authority for retroactive enforcement, allowing the licensing board to follow through on the due process that was just with a previous testifier, and allow us to complete matters where we can't get them resolved and have to go through the ALJ process, and still give the licensee the opportunity of due process. We are asking for retroactive enforcement for up to 2 years. This is language that has already been granted to the Department of Labor and Industry with many of their licenses, as well as the Department of Commerce. So this would be something that has already been granted to other agencies, and we are asking for that. We've had significant cases. I'll give the example of the Stillwater mayor, who was involved in a multi-million dollar scheme creating false tax returns for one of his clients. The board had to call a special order at the very last minute and try and get it resolved with the license expiring on December 31st and a board meeting taking place on December 30th. Without that, there would not have been a public order that we had been able to grant. But that was an agreed-upon order, and that's different from a contested case. So we have several cases where the clock has simply run out. Also in this particular bill, we are asking for the privilege of allowing our CPAs to be granted a retired status, meaning they can use retired in either before or after the title CPA. We have chronologically gifted licensees that have completed a complete career and don't have the legal authority to use retired CPAs. Again, this is very common in many of the other professions, including architecture, physicians, that sort of thing. So it allows the licensees to have the retired status. Also, we are behind the ball on how we serve our orders. We have to serve, currently the language requires us to do certified public certified mail, as well as U.S. mail, and those run about $8 a piece, which sounds like not a lot, but over the course of a year, we spend a lot on certified mail, which is no longer the means of sending orders, even in the legal profession, so we are asking to come into that arena. We are eliminating some fees back to the paper process. We used to do in-house the CPA app initial to sit for the exam, and that is now gone to the National Council, so applicants apply directly to the National Council to sit for their exam, and yet we are still collecting that fee, and we would like to eliminate that fee as well. There are some housekeeping changes, some definitions. I do want to also indicate to you that we have worked with the Minnesota Society of Certified Public Accountants, as well as the Minnesota Association of Public Accountants, and with their permission, I am testifying to the fact that they are in support of this bill as well. Mr. Chair, I have nothing else, but we'll sit for questions.
Questions? Wow. I see no questions. Representative Hewitt, do you want to renew your motion?
I do, Mr. Chair, and I must just have been getting so good at these bills.
Five punch this morning. Well, Representative Hewitt renews his motion that House File 893 be laid over for possible inclusion. And members,
thank you.
Because of the deadlines, we are scheduling a Friday meeting. We have a couple of bills that are coming up that are going to take a little more time, and so we can finish our work. So we'll be meeting on Friday. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the fair warning on Friday. I'm just wondering, I note in the fiscal note that came back on House File 5 that there's both an increase in cost for both MMB and Department of Revenue, and just wondering if we will be hearing that, or when we'll be hearing that bill, if that's on Friday or in sometime before we get to deadline.
Representative Albright, discussions are underway on that. We haven't got the bill in our possession yet, so hopefully we can get it done before Friday and before the deadlines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last night we learned of a Friday meeting in property taxes in the morning. I had made a dental appointment about 8 weeks ago. And I asked my wife to see what she could do about changing that to in the afternoon on Friday. Now I'm hearing another meeting on Friday, so do you have any idea on what time on Friday?
We're looking at 10 o'clock. And tentatively in room 120 in the Capitol is what, but we'll send an email out to that. But 10 o'clock is what we're looking at. So you can sleep in that morning.
Okay. Well, that will certainly overlap the other meeting in the morning. So thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
And I don't know if it's custom and usage, but typically when we have our first Friday meeting, and in particular in the Capitol, I think, isn't it the majority's freshman class that provides treats?
Representative Albright,
I'm just trying to remind myself whether that's in the rules or if that's just custom and usage.
Representative Albright, that may have been some custom and usage in the past, but the speaker has announced earlier on in session that we're not supposed to be harassing and our freshmen in such a way in that. So we'll see what happens.
Representative Albright, I think it was egg McMuffins, not treats.
I think actually, as I remember it now, it was actually the chair of the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Claypool.
The freshmen would appreciate mentorship by the
senior elders of this committee, and they could show us the example.
Then we'd be don't show up.
Just a curiosity, Mr. Chair, what is the committee's budget?
That was all, Representative Quab, we all saw the dollar figure that was there, and we'll look at that. We'll be looking next week to start putting our bill together. So,
Mr. Chair, a clarification.
Our Minister Craig Pinnick, I haven't been given that number. So, I guess I should ask.
So, Mr. Chair, there's no limit.
But, well, it's sort of like the cartoon that we put in the budget books. Yes, we don't have any money. We never had any money, and we're never going to have any money. So,
and I hate the treasurer's report.
Yes, thank you, sir. Anyway, members, with that, we're adjourned.